Hello and welcome to the Police Federation official podcast. My name is Martin Bahaja and I'm the head of communications for the organisation. And today I'm joined by PFEW's national chair, John Apter. Hi, John.
Hi, Martin. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. One thing I wanted to say before we begin on these podcasts, John, and I think you'll agree, is that we really want to give our members the chance to get involved. So we'd urge people listening or watching this to get in contact with us with any questions or ideas for future podcasts. And just so you're all aware, anyone listening, you can email us at communications@polfed.org, or you can contact us via Twitter, obviously, at PFEW_HQ. So we'd love to hear your ideas for future podcasts. So please do get in contact with us. Now, John, obviously it's been an exceptionally busy time for police forces up and down the country, probably one of the busiest years, I think, on record. But I suppose we should start by talking about the recent demonstrations and protests in London, in Bristol and elsewhere in the country. What are your thoughts, first of all, on the hostility our members have faced while policing these incidents?
Yeah, it has been a year like really like no other. And certainly the protests, we saw some protests, well, many protests last year, didn't we? And what often gets forgotten, especially in the media, is there's hundreds of protests that go on and they're unremarkable. You know, there's very little police presence, but obviously the ones that really grab the headlines are the ones where violence is shown towards our members. And what we've seen in recent weeks, especially in Bristol and in London, and we saw in other parts of the country as well, a real level of not only violence but hatred towards our colleagues, police officers, who are just simply trying to do their best. And look, I've always said we're not always going to get things right, but I do think that this year that we've had in this pandemic has created this sense of us and them for some, not all, and that tension that's built up like a pressure cooker. And it's our members, police officers, who are the brunt of that frustration out on the street. But certainly, especially in Bristol, the level of hatred was something I've not seen for a long, long time.
No, absolutely. And I guess as well, it kind of shows the world we're living in now, doesn't it? Because we've also had an illustration of the perils of social media with people perhaps focusing, people who, well, I will say, should know better, some of them, focusing on sort of 5 seconds of an event that lasted, say, 12 hours. You deal with a lot of the issues on social media. What are your thoughts on that?
I think let me start by saying I'm a real big advocate of social media. I've been using it for many, many years. But over the past couple of years, and I don't think it's just because of the role that I'm in, because obviously a change of role brings about, a change of tone sometimes from how some people see you, and I get that, but there's definitely been a change of tone, especially on Twitter, where it's become really toxic in some areas. And what you do have, you seem to have experts. I always use the example of, so you have Professor Chris Whitty, very relevant at the moment, who's clearly a very eminent man in his field, but he seems to have a platform on social media. But somebody with no medical experience, and in fact, somebody who just wants to argue about, you know, that it, whether it's day or night, will have the same equal platform as somebody like that. And their views are taken into account as much as somebody like Chris Whitty, for example, is. And I think that's really created this sense of skewed debate on social media. And some of it, I used to really get engaged in conversations on social media. I don't as much now, because you're sometimes debating with somebody who just want to fight with you, not no matter what. Well, then we have the other side of it. My colleagues are out there doing the best they can, and you'll have a camera phone stuffed in their face, and then within seconds it'll be on YouTube or on Twitter, and the armchair critics will be there saying what they did right, what they did wrong, vilifying them, sometimes undermining court proceedings that might have to follow. But it's never ending. And in the protests, we've seen, a use of social media in a real toxic way. And then you have apparently sensible people, whether it's people in the media, politicians, others with real influence, who are making a judgment on what they see on social media based on maybe a 5-second video clip. And they're putting out their vile comments, because that's what they sometimes are, which undermines confidence in policing, undermines what my colleagues are trying to do. And it really is disheartening. So the whole thing with social media has taken a bit of a negative tone. And I don't know how we're going to stop it. I really don't.
No, it's very sad, isn't it? And it's so hard to deal with. And obviously, John, our members are heavily involved in dealing with these events, as we discussed. But one of the things I wanted to touch on in this podcast as well is they might not be so aware of the process that the Federation will go through when issues like this occur around the country. So could you talk us through the process from your point of view? So, for example, the issues we saw in Bristol over a weekend a few weeks ago. What do you do when that happens, and who do you contact, and then how do we support the various branches around the country?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So when things nationally kick off like that, then I'll always make sure that the local branch has got the support that they need. And very often they're pretty self-sufficient and they've got everything they need. But just hopefully sometimes knowing that either me or Shay Donald, the National Vice Chair, are there on hand if they want any support, our comms team, whatever we can give in support. And then hopefully that gives a bit of reassurance. But also for me then, it's the other dimension. So I'm generally speaking to either chief constables, tactical commanders, generally chief constables or commissioners. And in some cases, I'll even pick up the phone to the Home Secretary or the Police Minister to make sure that they are aware of the reality of what is going on, you know, from our members' perspective about the level of violence. And then obviously then we'll pick up and work with the media. And we'll also make sure that the media is being monitored, as in what's going out on social media. And if we need to, then we'll interact and we'll set the record straight, so to speak. So an awful lot goes on behind the scenes, but, you know, ultimately we're about making sure our members have got the support they need. And if things are not going well, as in injuries are occurring, then we do everything we can to make sure they get the support they need.
Fantastic, thank you. Now, obviously our members are out there dealing with frontline policing and dealing with these large scale events during a worldwide pandemic. We've not seen anything like this before. We've not dealt with anything like this before. As an organisation, we've been calling on the government to prioritise vaccines for police officers. And I know you've been at the forefront of that, John, putting pressure on the government. Can you give our members an update on where we are with that at the moment?
Yeah, well, it's so frustrating. And as we are here and now, there is no movement politically. So what I want to reassure members is that we have really been doing all we can to get our colleagues vaccinated, prioritised for the vaccination. So if we go way back to the beginning of December when the vaccine programme was being rolled out, we were in discussions then with the National Police Chiefs Council, the Home Office, the Home Secretary and others. And actually, we were in a good place. The National Chiefs Council, very much on board, other people within policing, we were all on the same page. The Home Secretary, very supportive of our stance. Obviously, the JCVI, the independent body that makes the recommendations to government, they were going on the age. This is after the most vulnerable have been vaccinated, as well as the NHS. And we have never said that we should be ahead of those in the queue. But then as time moved on, it was clear that policing was not going to be prioritised. And it felt like a real betrayal. And the reason I say that is because we were convinced that our argument, which I believe was legitimate and proper and reasonable, we thought it had been heard and it was going to be actioned. But clearly there was a decision. And I've spoken to members of the JCVI. I respect what they do. And I've articulated the need for policing. And look, colleagues listening to this and watching this will know what I'm saying, because they're living and breathing it. It's the policing role throughout this pandemic has been unique. We are expected to get up close and personal. We're in and out of people's homes. Yes, because of the age profile, the risk of death and serious illness, thankfully, is lower than it could be. But we have lost colleagues, and many, many thousands of officers and staff have been off sick because of this virus or having to self-isolate. So we have been pushing. We've also got the leftover vaccine programme. Now, you know, we can't ignore it because it's important. I want our colleagues to get jabs in the arm in however they can. And every force will have a programme working with the local authority, the NHS, the fire service, about leftover vaccines being distributed to policing. Now, it works really well in some areas, not so well in others. It's getting better. So we're getting vaccine in that way. Some officers will now be getting vaccinated because of the age profile, so the over 50s, but the prioritisation is still an issue. Let's not forget, Martin, in the coming weeks and months, we're going to start having some large-scale events where police officers in the hundreds, if not thousands, are going to be deployed to different parts of the country. They're going to be travelling in carriers, staying in accommodation on top of each other, not literally, and they then run the risk of being super spreaders. So there's a real issue, a real issue. So, you know, we keep fighting and we're looking at every option, legal options as well, to challenge the government decision to make sure our colleagues get the prioritisation to the vaccine that they so rightly deserve.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure our members will be delighted to hear us saying that. One of the things that struck me as well is that through social media is that we obviously see members backing, obviously they would, our call for this, but members of the public as well, the vast majority of members of the public. Some of the articles we've written where people are saying, I actually thought police officers had been vaccinated along with NHS workers. So it's about raising that awareness for us, isn't it, as well?
It's just to reassure our members in particular that I and my colleagues are doing everything we possibly can, lobbying, looking at legal options. And I know it's contentious for some, but I just want to do the best for our colleagues because there is a vulnerability out there. And you know, I think they've been badly let down. I really do.
Yeah, absolutely. And on top of all that, I know you've spoken up this week about the G7 summit as well, and your fears that could become a super spreader event and potentially a number of unvaccinated members being deployed. Again, can you talk us through your concerns there, John?
Yeah, so I've raised this directly with the head of the National Police Chiefs Council, Martin Hewitt, and the Home Office. And it's legitimate concerns. You know, we're going to have a large number of officers being deployed down on the South Coast for this really important event. The majority of those officers, I would suspect, are not going to have received the vaccine. I mean, if they were to receive the vaccine in time, they should have had it a week or two ago. So they're not going to have it. That makes them vulnerable. You know, everybody is susceptible to this virus. So I think there's a real risk. The very least, but I still don't think this is acceptable. But the very least that we should expect is effective testing system in place for colleagues who are being deployed. But, you know, I'm not filled with confidence that we are in the right place yet for that. But again, doing everything we can, we've raised it, a legitimate concern. You know, we all want these events to be policed properly and effectively, but you've got to make sure that you look after the very people that you're asking to do that job. And I think they've been failed on the vaccination front.
Absolutely. And again, today it's been, as we say, it's been a busy week. And today we've just had the HMIC FRS review into the Clapham Common Vigil land, and we've been reading through it. And I've been drawn in particular to extracts specifically concerning police officers, our members, and that say officers did their best to peacefully disperse the crowd. They remained calm, professional when subjected to abuse. They did not act inappropriately or in a heavy-handed manner. These are all things we were saying at the time. We knew that their actions would be vindicated. And I know this has only landed today, so I don't want to put you on the spot, John, to start that. But what are your initial thoughts, given what has been said in the media about that incident and what we're reading now in this report?
You're right, it's only landed today. It doesn't surprise me, Martin, what is in the report. And the reason I say that's not through arrogance. It's because on the night of that vigil for Sir Everard, I was in contact with my colleagues from the Metropolitan Federation, with the Commissioner of the Metropolitan and Deputy Commissioner. And I knew that the difficulties that colleagues were facing on the ground, doing their absolute best, protests, whether they're apparently peaceful, a vigil, you would say, well, is a peaceful protest. But there's tactics that some people, not all, some people use, which make them far from peaceful. And the challenges that my colleagues faced on that night were very real. What really incensed me, was the commentary from, look, there will always be some people who, no matter what we do, they'll never love the police because of what we have to do. I get that. But there's others, whether it's parliamentarians, whether it's others who hold high office, people in the media who were coming out with some very toxic comments and observations without knowing the full facts other than what they'd seen on Twitter, maybe in a short video. And I know, I'm the first to say, some protests, what you see is not always pretty, you know, because the response by police, we have to get hands on. And, you know, I had some pretty vile comments from people saying, you know, why does it take four people to carry away an innocent, vulnerable female? Well, actually, the reason it takes four officers is because we want to keep the individual that they're carrying away safe. And that's why they use four officers. It's tactics that policing uses. So I welcomed the very quick intervention of the request for the report, the independent report from HMICFRS. I made a point, and for colleagues listening and watching this, Sir Tom Windsor heads up the Her Majesty's Inspectorate. I have regular contact with Sir Tom. I made a point of not contacting him prior to this report being released, but I spoke to him today after the report went out, and he was very clear, especially around my colleagues' actions. He was saying they were dignified, they were professional, they were restrained. But the commentary from those who should know better not only damaged my colleagues' confidence on the night and beyond, but it undermined the confidence the public have in policing. And at the moment, more than ever, that is an incendiary thing to do. So, you know, I've put out some words today in the media, and I've called on those people who were very, very quick to jump to a conclusion then, to vilify my colleagues. You know, be just as quick to put out your apology. Let's see if they are. I doubt they will be though, Martin.
No, it's a shame, absolutely. I think just to illustrate that point, as you were saying earlier when we were talking about social media, the Bristol event, wasn't it? There was a bizarre tweet from somebody with a lot of followers who suggested that police forces were placing police vans in certain areas so they'd be attacked. And it's very difficult to argue with that level of, well, that lack of intelligence, isn't it? With some people making these points.
I think what really surprises me, and you know what, I'm not naive, been around the block a few times, been in policing a long time, I'm not naive, but what surprises me, you know, there will be stupid people who will put stupid comments on social media, but the amount of people who believe it, that the police place vans in certain locations, hoping that the public are going to set them on fire because it looks good in the media. I mean, really, is that really what people expect? And let's not forget, one of those vans that was they were trying to set on fire had police officers in it. So some of the, I hate to use a phrase because it's been hijacked by some, but some of the fake news that you see from people, certainly on social media, is incredibly damaging. I do think as a society, and this is much, much broader than policing, as a society, we really need to understand what we want from social media and what we allow, what are the boundaries. I'm a big believer in free speech. But that doesn't mean that you allow anything and everything to be said because it can cause so much damage. But yeah, the some of the stuff that was going out during those protests were just bonkers, absolutely bonkers.
Yeah, astonishing. Well, look, thanks, John. That's really informative. But I think we should end this podcast looking forward and on a high. So obviously we're looking ahead at our plans for the rest of the year. We're in the process, aren't we, of finalising our plans for the conference, virtual conference. And you've been integral in the planning and that side of things. So do you want to tell our members a bit about what's planned and what we hope to achieve with it?
Yeah, we have to do things differently this year. Normally, for the last couple of years since I've been in post, we've had to keep cancelling conferences because whether we get hit with cyber malware attacks or pandemics, so we've had to adapt and change. So conference is going to be a virtual conference this year. It's going to be two relatively short days, and you'll hear from key people like the Home Secretary. People will have to put up with a short, I promise, speech from me. You're going to hear from key people in policing. We'll probably talk about things like the protests, our approach to protests, the uplift program of the 20,000 officers that we're recruiting. We want to hear from our members as well. We'll be reaching out on social media about our members, about what they want to hear, and can they add their voice to our conference? And there might be hopefully some key individuals that will be wanting to address the conference and talk directly to our reps. Let's not forget, this is for our reps, really important people out there who are doing their absolute best, juggling, very often juggling two full-time roles out of their day job and being a federation rep. So yeah, we'll have some messages, key messages for our reps, and also talk about the brilliant stuff that we do, you know, around well-being. I know, you know, the federation gets a kick in sometimes, rightly so, but we don't deserve everything we get. We're doing some really good stuff around well-being, working with the College of Policing, influencing proper change around the misconduct regulatory changes. People keep saying to me, or some people keep saying to me, yeah, but you're not a union. No, we're not a union. We're a staff association. We don't have the same rights as a union. But what we do as a staff association is much, much broader, much broader. If you look, and I know I'm digressing slightly, Martin, but bear with me. If you look at the policing bill that's going through Parliament, I know some parts of it are contentious, but better protection for police drivers, increasing the sentences of those who assault emergency workers, having a police covenant, allowing specials to be members of the Federation if they want to, all our wish list, all things that we've been lobbying for, and things like repealing the Bail Act, really important. We've been instrumental in pushing for that as well. So some really good stuff that's happening. And on top of all of that, it's an election year for the Police Federation. So I would urge people, if you're thinking either I could do better than him, as in me, then please stand to be a Fed rep. Being a Fed rep for me really changed my career in a really positive way. I'm not on about having the privilege of being in this this national position. When I was a local Fed rep, when I was on shift, helping my colleagues, supporting my colleagues, and it's not all about, as important as it is, the pay and conditions. It's about challenging that flexible working application that's being turned down, or making sure that people get the leave that they're entitled to, or making sure that somebody gets the support around mental health. Doing that at a local level really makes a difference. So if you're interested, then please look out for a campaign we're going to be starting very soon called Reps at Work. It's going to be all over social media, get an email to you as well. Come and be a part of the Police Federation and make that difference that you want to make.
Fantastic. There's no better way to end this podcast, John, than saying that. And I'm sure that'll be an inspiration to many people listening out there who are thinking of doing the same and trying to make that difference. But John, thanks so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to record this with me. Very grateful. And excuse me while I clear my throat. As I said earlier, we're really keen to hear from members. So if anybody out there has any comments about this podcast, any suggestions or ideas for future episodes, please do contact us. Again, I'll give you the email address. It's communications@polefed.org, or you can contact us on our Twitter page at @PFEW_HQ or via our Facebook page. All that's left for me to do is say thanks very much for tuning in. Thank you again, John. We'll be back soon with we've got plenty more podcasts planned. So this is the first of many planned, and we're also going to put these on YouTube so people can watch as well to see what we both look like. John, I know we were both saying we both need a haircut, so but we live in testing times, don't we? But thanks again. Thanks again to everybody listening and watching. We look forward to hearing from you. Stay safe, and we'll see you again soon. Goodbye.